Les colloques du Collège de France.
Bonjour à tous. Thanks so much, Denis, for inviting me to this symposium. It's a lot of fun to be here. This is what we are working on. And this is an illustration, roughly, of my daily brain activity. We are interested in the molecular basis of phenotypic evolution across vertebrates. What are the genetic changes explaining this astounding diversity of morphological, physiological, and behavioral phenotypes? And essentially, if you think about it, there are three types of mutational events that can contribute to phenotypic innovation. There are regulatory mutations leading to changes in gene expression during evolution. There are mutations changing the sequence of the gene product, and then somewhat more radical, there can be the emergence of new genes that then can further evolve through smaller mutations. Now, it's thought that regulatory mutations are the main drivers of phenotypic evolution. And that's why we have been studying gene expression evolution and its regulatory basis across basically all dimensions you can imagine here. Both sexes from different species, different organs, different cell types in these organs, across development, different expression layers, coding genes, non-coding genes, all genes shared across species and new genes that arose more recently in evolution. And today I want to focus on this organ, the brain, and the context of all of these dimensions. And I chose this story today because I was hoping that, like many humans, you're also interested in what makes us unique. And the large and the complex brain that gives us presumably higher cognitive functions and distinguishes us even from our closest evolutionary relatives, the chimpanzees, may be such a trait. Although I just want to note that maybe our cognitive functions are not that high in the end. We are not such an intelligent species. But I don't want to bring the mood down, so let's just continue a more positive note. Let's look at the molecular evolution of the brain in the context of the evolution of other organs. Let's look at the evolutionary dynamics of the molecular evolution of the brain. And it turns out if you build gene expression trees based on gene expression data directly, where the branch lengths reflect the amount of gene expression change that has accumulated during evolution, you see something interesting, that the brain branches are very short compared to those of the liver, and in particular those of the testis here. So the molecular evolution of the brain has been very slow, which may seem surprising to some of you, right? And to understand the evolutionary forces explaining this slow evolution, we can look at the properties of the genes expressed in the cell types, based on our cell type specific data of these different organs. And what you see, for example, is that genes expressed in brain cell types have low mutational tolerances, okay, compared to cell types of the liver or in particular the testes and late spermatogenesis here. Okay, so there's strong purifying selection on the brain constraining its molecular evolution. How about innovation? How about positive selection? So we can measure it, for example, by the incorporation of new genes into gene expression programs of the different cell types in the brain compared to the cell types of the other organs. And we see in the brain, few new genes have been incorporated into the gene expression programs in all of the brain cell types. You can see, there's little innovation in the brain by this measure. And how about development? Let's look across development. And we see a similar pattern for all developmental stages, where basically in the brain, few genes have been incorporated, new genes at all the different stages from early development to the adult, compared, for example, especially to the liver and also to the testis, which has its own scale here. We can also look at other types of innovation, sort of positive selection in the coding sequences, giving rise to new amino acid sequences. And we see overall, again, few genes in the brain compared to the other organs that have been shaped by positive selection throughout development. And overall, there's a pattern here that I want to allude you to, that progressively, in later stages of development, there's more innovation. And that is explained by decreasing selective constraints, decreasing purifying selection, facilitating innovation in later developmental stages. So you can see it goes up sort of these innovation gradients here throughout development. And this kind of beautifully mirrors the morphological observations by Carl von Baer in the 19th century, who already observed at that time increase in morphological differentiation between species during development. So how can we reconcile this slow evolution of the brain with this amazing phenotypic diversity of the brain across mammals and other vertebrates? Well, we think that overall the brain cannot change much globally at the regulatory level, because it has very fine-tuned, constrained regulatory networks. So, but these big phenotypic changes are explained by a few key regulatory changes of big effect that may underlie this innovation. That's the hypothesis. And they won't increase the overall rates of molecular evolution. How about the other organs? In the liver, we think that the rapid evolution of the liver reflects many metabolic diet adaptations to new diets during evolution. And there's strong positive selection on the liver and low selective constraints. And this is something we investigated in this study that I encourage you to look at. There's a preprint out there where we discover recent molecular innovations in the liver associated with dietary innovations. And actually, we even find that the cellular architecture of the hepatocytes, which is a key metabolic cell types in the liver, is different in mammals from other vertebrates. So it's emerged in the common ancestor of mammals, this what we call zonation in the liver. But that's another story, not for today, but please check it out. How about the testis? Okay, this guy looks quite relaxed. But us poor mammalian males are under strong pressure to give rise to our own offspring. And this strong pressure called sperm competition, we think, accelerates the morphological and hence the molecular evolution of the testis. So even across the great apes, testicle sizes, for example, are very different. Okay, and this is because it reflects the amount of promiscuous behavior of the female. So the bonobo male in particular is under strong pressure to produce a lot of sperm to compete with the other males, because bonobo females are particularly promiscuously mating. Okay, whereas the gorilla silverback, impressive in body size, is not so impressive in terms of testicle size, because it can be rather sure to sire its own offspring. Okay, and so of the intermediate testicle size in humans, you may think about what that tells us about the sort of long-term evolutionary promiscuous behavior of females. Okay, for us. But anyway, so there's a strong pressure on male reproductive so sex called sperm competition, which implies strong positive selection. And there's also reduced purifying selection, and you can ask me later how we actually measure this, but I don't have time to go into this right now. Okay, from the testis back to the brain. This is a mouse brain, and these are the principal structures of the mouse brain, the forebrain, the midbrain, and the hindbrain, and the respective substructures here. And they are essentially shared across all vertebrates, suggesting that they emerged in the common vertebrate ancestor, with one exception, and maybe you spot it, I will not reveal just yet, with one exception, okay? But so we have been interested in particular in the evolution of the telencephalon, which is thought to underlie the evolution of higher cognitive functions in different lineages. And so here in this study, we did a big single cell study to unravel sort of the molecular and cellular basis of the higher cognitive functions of birds, which can be super intelligent as the most intelligent mammals like the great apes. Maybe not like us, depending on how you define intelligence, right? But this is a published study. I'm not going to talk about this today. We have an ongoing study on the telencephalon, where we have representatives of all major vertebrate lineages included. I'm not going to talk about this either today. So I want you to focus now on the lineage down here, the jawless vertebrates, like the sea lamprey. And this is going to provide the inroad for the main study I'm going to talk about today. So the sea lamprey as a jawless vertebrate, why is it interesting? It's very interesting because by virtue of comparisons of data from the lamprey with data from jawed vertebrates, the sister lineage here, all the other vertebrates, we can infer ancestral states, in this case, of the brain of all vertebrates. So how did the original vertebrate brain look like? And so we generated neural cell type atlas for the sea lamprey to illuminate the origins of the vertebrate brain. And, you know, it's quite a scary species. And yes, it is also dangerous to humans if you challenge it. But basically, we can then look at the root of the vertebrate tree, how the brain looked like, and, you know, to focus on, we made many observations there on the most fundamental innovation that we saw there is that, well, we discovered that the sea lamprey and other jawed vertebrates has no cerebellum. There's no trace of cerebellar cell types at all in the jawless vertebrates. Okay. From this, we could infer that the cerebellum, the cerebellar cell types, emerged in the stem lineage of jawed vertebrates, likely in association to support the evolution of paired appendages and fins and the increased predatory behavior, which requires more complex motor control, which is thought to be the main function of the cerebellum, at least was thought to be the main function for a long time. And the cerebellum, we hypothesize, originated through duplication of ancestral cerebellar-like structures that are present also in the jawless vertebrates. But I'm not going to talk about this today more either. We are currently investigating this. I want to focus on the more recent evolution of the cerebellum in therian mammals, that is placental and marsupial mammals. And it's very interesting, the observation that the cerebellum shows strong signals of coevolution with the neocortex, which clearly, you know, is involved in the evolution of higher cognitive functions, where the ratio of cerebellar neurons relative to neocortical neurons has been remarkably stable, suggesting that the cerebellum may really also be involved in the evolution of higher cognitive functions. And indeed, plenty of studies in the past 10, 20, 30 years highlighting the importance of the cerebellum to the higher cognitive functions like language and working memory, also reflected in the respective disorders listed here. Fun fact, if you take all neurons of the brain in humans, and then you will find 80% of them in the cerebellum, which is remarkable, right? It's densely packed with neurons, the cerebellum, with small granule cells that I will talk about more in a moment, okay? If you do the same counting in the elephants, 95% of all neurons you will find in the cerebellum. So it's really an amazing structure, and we sought to reconstruct systematically its cellular and molecular evolution across mammals. And so you can see it's very diverse in terms of structures and sizes, with a focus on the human lineage, in particular on the recent changes explaining the co-expansion of the cerebellum with the neocortex on the recent lineage, during the recent primate evolution on the lineage leading to humans. So the question is, can we identify some of these key regulatory changes of big effect that I hypothesize explain the evolution of the brain? And before I go into our study, just I want to introduce quickly the main cell types I'm going to talk about today in the cerebellum. This is the Purkinje cell, arguably the most beautiful cell type in the whole body. I don't know what's your favorite cell type, but it has this huge dendritic tree, which with hundreds in humans, hundreds of thousands, up to a million synapses. It's a huge cell that's super arborized. And it integrates, it's an inhibitory cell type, and it integrates the information of these granule cells, which are the cells, the neurons, that explain this amazing number of neurons in the cerebellum compared to the rest of the brain. And so this integrated signal of the Purkinje cells is projected, or the Purkinje cells project to the deep nuclei this information, which is then passed on to other regions of the central nervous system. And so these two cell types are the key players today and progenitor cells that give rise to them during development, okay? So what can we do these days with these amazing technologies, single cell transcriptome sequences? We generated huge atlases, developmental atlases from early embryonic development to the adult, single cell transcriptome atlases for humans, the mouse, and the opossum, which is a marsupial, and it serves as an outgroup, overall covering about 160 million years of evolution. And so you can see down here the data in the UMAPs. And one challenge when you have such data is how do you compare across species? An important thing now is to align the corresponding stages between species, right? To make the data comparable in the end. And how do we do this? We do this based on the transcriptome similarity of the different stages, matching the most closely related stages in terms of transcriptome similarities. And what we find there is, for example, that the day 13.5 mouse embryo corresponds to an 8-week human embryo, which in turn corresponds to a 4-day-old postnatal opossum, which highlights what you may all know and how immature marsupials are when they are born. So their embryonic development largely takes place outside of the body, and they sort of remain attached to the teats of the mother for a long time, and they have this enormous lactation cycle that basically makes them grow from the embryo to proper young and then adult animals. Okay, the next thing that we need to do before we can analyze the data after assigning developmental stages, we need to annotate cell types. And we do this with marker genes, etc. And so you can see nicely here the different colors represent the different cell types. And you can see how the Purkinje cells emerge from the progenitor pool here in the ventricular zone. And the granule cells emerge also from the different sets of progenitors in the rhombic lip, so main germinal zones of the cerebellum. And now the first sort of real analysis in this project. Let's look at the cell abundance dynamics of the main cell types that I introduced to you today. So first we have the progenitors that then give rise to the other cell types. And then you can see basically that then the Purkinje cells expand and then the granule cells completely take over, right? Then they basically make up nearly all of the cells in the cerebellum in later development. And we have the similar pattern in all the species, but maybe you can already appreciate that the height of the blue bars in humans might be a bit relatively larger than in the other species. And indeed, when we quantify this systematically, at the time when Purkinje's abundance is the highest across species, there is a particularly high abundance, relative abundance of Purkinje cells in humans, okay, around 8 weeks of post-conception. So there's a burst of Purkinje cell production, which is super interesting because Purkinje cells are known to regulate granule cell proliferation. So is this the driver of the human cerebellum expansion? And so you can sort of, these are relative abundances, it's followed by granule cell precursor proliferation, and then the granule cells, you can see a slight axis here in terms of relative amounts to fully understand the proliferation dynamics, we would need absolute counts of cells. And this is difficult to do, and this needs to be done in the future, but this we cannot do. So the exact consequences of the Purkinje cell abundance here in humans still remains to be explored. But so when did it happen? So it happened after the human mouse split on the human lineage, right? And I'm going to give you a sneak peek of data that I'm going to discuss more a bit later, where we also generated developmental data for the cerebellum and all the cell types for the marmoset monkey, which is a new world monkey, which then allowed us, given that the marmoset also does not have this burst of Purkinje cell production like the mouse and the opossum, polarize the emergence of this burst of Purkinje cell production to the human lineage after the separation from the new world monkey lineage represented by the marmoset here. So it occurred in the past 40 million years or so on the lineage leading to humans. So what's the gene expression, the molecular basis of this expansion and other innovations of the cerebellum? We can now look at the gene expression data, okay, that underlies also the previous analysis in the end, right? So this is a principal component analysis where the different colors indicate the different cell types, the different symbols indicate the different species, and the size of the symbol tells us about where we are in development. The smaller, the earlier, okay? And what you can hopefully appreciate here is that there is a cell type dominated clustering where a human granule cell is closer to an opossum granule cell to a human progenitor cell, for example, right? rather than species-dominated clustering, which could in principle happen as well if there's rapid evolution. But this pattern overall suggests that gene expression programs in the cerebellum are largely conserved. And this nicely resolves earlier studies from our lab where we generated RNA sequencing data for thousands of organ samples from different mammals and a bird. And what you can see here nicely, sort of how the organs emerge from common gene expression programs here that then make them distinct during development, or they get distinct. And you can see an organ-dominated clustering where, for example, a human cerebellum of a given stage is closer to an opossum cerebellum of a given stage than to a human liver. These are, by the way, more or less the different three germ layers here represented by these organs here. Okay, so overall, gene expression programs are conserved. Also, going back to the cerebellum here, is indicated by sort of this cell type dominated clustering. You might say, boring, right? Everything is conserved. But of course, we are looking for a few changes, potentially of big effect, and there are radical changes. For example, in terms of trajectory changes of gene expression. So here, for example, the syncope genes in the granule cells show sort of the inverse gene expression trajectory going from low expression to high expression during development in humans compared to mouse and opossum, the outgroup here. So there's a completely radical inversion of gene expression here. And just an example of a number of cases, and this gene is duplicated in group 4 medulloblastomas, a childhood brain tumor that has been difficult to model in the mouse. And our data for this example, and also already in the bulk era, illustrates the biomedical relevance of our data because, you know, given this completely different expression trajectory, probably this gene has a very different function in humans compared to the other species. And this explains why this gene is not well modeled in the mouse, or the implications of this gene. Okay, so we have this radical trajectory changes, and if we count them, we see an excess of these granule cell trajectory changes on the human lineage in granule cells. So there's a substantial overabundance of such changes in granule cells, which, again, is exciting for us going back to our old bulk tissue data, where it explains sort of the excess of cerebellum trajectory changes overall that we saw that are even larger the number on the human lineage compared to those occurring in the neocortex, which again highlights or supports the idea that the cerebellum and innovation in the cerebellum contributed to the evolution of higher cognitive functions in humans. Okay, so these are trajectory changes, changes in the pattern of expression over development. And to some extent, you could say there's something even more radical than that, and that is the gain and loss of gene expression across cell types during evolution. And so there's one example here, like the D-SCAM gene is a cell adhesion molecule previously known to be important in neural circuit formation during development. And this gene gained expression in progenitor cells during human evolution after the separation from the mouse lineage here. And when we count these changes to look for excesses in different cell types or for different species, we don't see anything particular at the first glance. But when we look at development, we do see something interesting. So overall, these gains and losses in human and mouse of gene expression in different cell types tends to increase or tends to affect later stages of development, which again is consistent sort of with this overall, let's call it von Baer pattern of innovation. But there are exceptions. So there's an excess of gains of expression in early granule cells and, very interestingly, in early progenitors. And this is interesting in the context of previous findings by others who reported that there might be human-specific basal progenitors in the cerebellum in early development. And so if together, this may suggest that this gains of expression in the progenitors might have contributed to the specification of these human-specific progenitors and also other changes in the proliferation dynamics of these progenitors. Okay, so now at this stage of the project, we had sort of this overall hypothetical scenario that we came up with, where the human expression gains contributed to new types of progenitors and changes in proliferation dynamics that might be associated with the burst of Purkinje cell expansion that I showed you before in humans. And then, given that Purkinje cells regulate granule cell proliferation, this burst of Purkinje cell production might explain, or seems to explain, the burst of granule cell production afterwards. And these granule cells then further evolved through an excess of trajectory expression changes and expression gains. Can we identify the underlying regulatory mutations of this scenario? So, we think that most gene regulatory innovation comes through the evolution of new distal cis regulatory elements or their modifications. And so, of course, then we sought to systematically identify cis regulatory elements across stages of the cerebellum in all the species. And how do we do that? Well, regulatory elements can be rather readily be identified based on the chromatin accessibility. So chromatin in active regulatory elements tends to be open. And so there are techniques called ATAC sequencing, where we systematically across the genome can map open chromatin regions and hence cis regulatory elements. And then the aim is to identify the sequence changes that explain the activity, the accessibility of the cis regulatory elements. Which is usually should be transcription factor binding motifs that then explain this activity. And so how do we do this? So we generate, again, a lot of data. We generate a lot of single nucleus ATAC sequencing data matched to the RNA sequencing data for the different species here. Again, a lot of data to churn. And I just want to highlight to you a little bit of how these data look like by showing you the mouse. As an example, and what is the main take-home message from this slide should be how spatio-temporally specific cis-regulatory element activity or accessibility in this case is. So you can see here the dark colors highlight accessibility of the different cis-regulatory elements, and you can see in the different cell types and developmental stages, and you can see that the bulk of the cis-regulatory elements are very specific to certain cell types and or specific stages of development. Okay, and this highlights how the emergence of new cis regulatory elements can contribute in a very specific manner to gene regulatory innovation. And so what we could do now is we could link this data with our expression data from the six species, right, to reconstruct the regulatory basis of gene expression evolution. But we thought at the time, six species, there are thousands of mammals, hundreds of genomes available for the mammals. Six species is not so much in the end, right? But the problem is that already just the reagents for the six species cost about 350,000 euros. And if you wanted to scale it up, for example, to the 240 species for which Zoonomia Consortium made these beautiful genome alignments that are very useful, it would become financially prohibitive. We would need many ERC grants to sort of finance this type of work. What's the solution to this dilemma? Artificial intelligence. Deep learning, a blessing and a curse these days in our world, right? But basically, this is just, I'm really kind of blown away by the possibilities still. AI-powered deep learning models, they can learn, if you give them a sequence, in this case, the ATAC data, so where the cis-regulatory elements are across the different cell types, developmental stages, they can learn what are the sequences explaining this accessibility and sort of can be used to predict CREs and why they are accessible and in the end active. And we can even predict across species, we thought. Okay, not just analyze within a species. And so basically, we did that. We trained deep learning models based on human ATAC sequencing data in this example here. It took a human perspective, right? We always have humans sort of as a central focal species here. And then we use the train model to predict accessibility in orthologous sequences in all the other species, in 240 mammals from the zoonomia alignment. And in this hypothetical scenario, we would predict accessibility in all the other primates, and hence we could infer that this cis-regulatory element emerged in the common ancestor of primates. Okay? That's the idea. And that's what we did systematically for all the CREs. For all the different, you know, these NMF factors summarize cell types and so distinct cell types and developmental stages and so on. And so each column corresponds to a cis-regulatory element here, and each row to a species of the placental mammal phylogeny. And so basically, where the color is all blue across all rows, this suggests that the human cis-regulatory element is accessible in all placental mammals, suggesting it originated in common mammalian ancestors. And then there are progressively younger elements here that arose later in the primate lineage. And then we're including human-specific elements where our models predict that there's no accessibility in any other species, suggesting it's a human-specific enhancer, for example. Now, you might say, predictions, right? Yeah, but we of course need to validate that it works. And we can do that because we have now the data from only six species, but they are anchor species that can be used to validate our predictions in a beautiful way. For example, for all the cis-regulatory elements that we predict to be human-specific, we can now look in those anchor species here in the actual attack sequencing data and in the corresponding sequences of these CREs, do we get attack signals or not? And you can see for the ones where we predict human specificity in all the other species, bonobo, macaque, marmoset, and mouse, basically has very little ataxic signals for the corresponding sequence. So it suggests that it's really human specific, but the bulk of the CREs that we predict to be human specific. And we can do the same for all the other age categories here. And for example, then the eutherian conserved ones where we predict accessibility across all placental mammals, we actually get strongest attack signals in all of the species here. So it's fully consistent with the predictions. And now we are in a good position. We have a high resolution, at least for the regulatory elements, a very high, phylogenetically high resolution data set here, and that we can link to gene expression changes. And this is towards the end of my talk now, I want to focus on this very interesting expression gain that we detected. So the thyroid hormone receptor beta gene, THRB, is a transcription factor gene that with known key roles in cell proliferation and migration. And I put an exclamation mark after transcription factor because transcription factors are usually very conserved in evolution because they target many genes, they regulate other genes. So if you change the activity of a transcription factor, this usually has deleterious consequences, right, because of all the downstream effects. They're usually very constrained in the evolution. But in this case, we have this radical innovation where basically this THRB gene gained expression in the progenitor cells. And not only that, the target genes of this transcription factor also show expression gains during evolution on the human lineage. So is this a change of expression that after the human marmot split that could have contributed in the end to the Purkinje cell expansion? That's the hypothesis here. And so, but first let's just look at what drove this gain of expression of THRB in progenitor cells. It turns out it seems to be driven by a gain of one key enhancer element that sits 3 kb upstream of the transcriptional start site of the THRB gene. And so this is the attack sequencing data. So this is the peak here in humans, no peak in the other species, fully consistent also with it driving the expression of THRB. And there's a very strong association. I could go more details. We have built gene regulatory networks, et cetera. So this gene, this regulatory element, this likely enhancer, likely drove the expression of THRB. And then we use our models, our deep learning models, to predict accessibility across species, we see the highest prediction score in humans and other great apes. and lower signals in macaque and marmoset. Consistent with an emergence of this enhancer, a full functionality in great apes, in recent great ape evolution on the human lineage. And then we can do with these deep learning models, we can do in silico mutagenesis and ask questions of, if you take away that nucleotide or revert it to the ancestral state, what does the model still think that this enhancer is accessible or not? And so this way you can reconstruct sort of the significance of individual substitutions. And basically, in a nutshell, the model thinks that the SOX2 transcription factor binding sites, together with the PAX transcription factor binding sites here, explain the accessibility of the human and the great ape specific enhancer element. And interestingly, this PAX element, this is really required to explain the activity of the CRE, arose through an A to G transition substitution in the common ancestor of great apes very recently here, consistent with its recent activity emergence. So overall, we have then this scenario here, which is still overall, there's many things to solve here, but where the THRB transcription factor gain of expression in early progenitor cells, together with the gain of expression of its target genes through the enhancer modification, led to innovations in the progenitor pools here, potentially the specification of the human-specific basal progenitors, which in the end facilitated the Purkinje cell expansion, this burst of production of Purkinje cells that I showed you earlier. And given that Purkinje cells regulate granule cell proliferation, this is thought to underlie the burst of granule cell proliferation, and they evolve further through expression gain and trajectory changes. And overall, then this is a candidate case of a key regulatory change of big effect that might underlie major brain innovation, in this case, the expansion and functional diversification of the cerebellum during recent human evolution. And there's, of course, a lot of downstream work to sort of support, validate, and clarify this overall hypothesis. So, for example, we have an ongoing knockout study in the cerebellar organoids where the enhancer was knocked out. And so it will be interesting to see if these knockout organoids in humans grow smaller than the control organoids. And then it will be fun to put this enhancer also into mice and see if they grow bigger cerebelli. So with this, for today, I will end here. I want to thank all the people involved, and in particular, the European Research Council. We would never have been able to produce all this expensive data without this support. And I thank you for your attention, and I'm ready to take questions.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.